Hello, ladies. Welcome to Women Words Wisdom, which is a podcast for women over 50 who want to challenge cultural narratives surrounding aging. Let's recognize and celebrate the raw truth behind what we wise women are learning and experiencing. My name is Robin Enright Salcedo, and I'm your host for the podcast. I believe we have a choice in how we face our aging. We can look at it with dread, or we can look at it with curiosity. If you believe that 60 is the new 40, this isn't the right podcast for you. Let's face this head on, and let's talk about the real issues. Let's find a way through it together. In 2010, I began what I thought at the time was my greatest life adventure, a move from Massachusetts to Boulder, Colorado at the age of 51. I loaded up my Subaru, bought my cockapoo, Tigger, a booster seat so he could see out the window, and I pointed my car west to begin my new life. While this was indeed a great life adventure, I've realized that the greatest adventure of my life was something I missed beginning altogether, my journey into older age and the many new doors that opened and new chapters that began. And while my drive to Colorado was meticulously mapped out, this adventure has not been. I'm a storyteller who uses the written word and photography to provide a glimpse of my subjects, so why not create a project that focuses on all the ways we end and begin again during this life phase? So I'm curious, who are you? What are you working on? Who and what inspires you? What royally pisses you off? What new chapters have you begun? I promise to be real with you. No bullshit. It's kind of scary, to be honest, but since I've always made sense of the universe through writing and allowing myself to be vulnerable, I guess I'm willing to risk it. Welcome to the Women Words Wisdom Podcast Conversation Series. Today, I am speaking with Kika Dorsey. Kika is a poet and fiction writer in Boulder, Colorado, and lives with her two children, husband, and pets. Her books include Beside Herself, three full-length collections, Rust, Coming Up for Air, and Occupied, Vienna is a Broken Man, and Daughter of Hunger. She has been nominated for the Pushcart Prize 4 times. Currently, she is an instructor of English at the Front Range Community College and works as a writing coach, editor, tutor, and ghostwriter. In her free time, she swims miles in pools and runs and hikes in the open space of Colorado's mountains and plains. I first had the honor of meeting Kika when she agreed to an interview for the conversation section of our stories today. In addition to her responding to interview questions, I photographed her and we had a fair amount of time to get to know one another. So when Occupied came out, I was intrigued. Intrigued and then immensely moved and involved in her delicious use of language, some of which you will be treated to today when Kika reads a few of her poems. Occupied reads like nonfiction, is rich in historical context, and deeply personal. I am honored to welcome Kika today. And I'm thinking, Kika, we should just jump right in and start with one of your poems as a launching point for this podcast.
Okay, great. Thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here. I'm going to start with my first poem in the book, which was the first poem I wrote that ended up becoming this book, and it's called Hunger. I'm hungry all the time. We forage in the Alps for mushrooms and elderberry blossoms that we dip in cornmeal and fry from the butter of a neighbor's cow. The oak and beech disappear as I climb further to fir, larch, and pine. I pick edelweiss and arnica and set it in the blue glass vase on our table. We eat the polenta with what we have gathered, and Muti is always angry, Fatih a traveling tailor and never around, hungry stepchildren. Once we accidentally ate poisonous mushrooms. I knew something was wrong when the August light turned orange and from the faces of Russian soldiers emerged black beetles, and my brother lay holding his stomach and vomiting. My stomach is full of knives. It is an empty cavern where my dead mother dwells below budding breasts. Sometimes I want to cross the River Mur and never return. Sometimes the river roils in my body and I pull the sun into me. Sometimes I see a golden eagle on the elm tree. He looks royal, as if he's won a war.
Wow. There is so, I'm not exaggerating when I tell you, I think I read every one of your poems, like I'm tearing up a little bit, because you are so, I'm there. I'm absolutely right there. And I read every one of your poems and then I stop. And then I can't fly through your poetry. It's making me think a lot and it's putting me in a place that it's almost like I need to pop out of it before I pop back in again. I'd love, you know, I know a little bit about your family history. I'd love for you to share where this poem came from. How did we get here? How did we get to this beautiful work?
Well, this poem was the poem that launched me into writing the book, though when I wrote the poem, I didn't know that. Mm-hmm. Basically, my mother had Alzheimer's, and I was her caretaker for 6 years until she died. And so she was losing all her memories, and I started feeling like I wanted to excavate them. My mother grew up in Leoben, and before that, Retz, which is why I have the River Mur, in Austria, post-war. And she was born in 43, so she was quite young when the war ended. And she would tell me stories about the war, and she would always talk about the hunger. You know, Germany and Austria experienced a lot of hunger afterwards. And so a lot of this book is the price of war, and especially the price on the children. So my mother was a child at the time, and she used to faint from malnutrition. I mean, you know, it was bad. And so so in this poem, you know, this is the poem that's closest to pre-research, where I just told my mom's story. You know, she had a stepmother because her mother died of lupus when my mom was about, I think, 9. And then, you know, she also had a brother and told the story. They used to forage in the Alps for food a lot, you know. And one time they picked the wrong kind of mushroom. And my uncle Willie ate poison, you know, they all ate these poisonous mushrooms and just totally tripped out and got very sick. And my uncle probably ate more of them or something because he got so sick that he ended up developing permanent liver damage.
Wow.
From that experience.
Wow. How did you, when you, I'm not a poet. How do things start for you? I mean, so we understand a little bit about, this is about your mother and that history. How does how does it enter into your mind to begin? Like, in other words, I guess what I'm trying to say is, with this particular poem, did it just come to you? Did you sit down and say, I want to write about this? Or what is your creative process when something takes a hold of you?
That's really hard to say because I'm always a step behind myself. In other words, the poetry moves forward into the realm of an unknown, and I don't really know what I'm doing until after the fact. Mm-hmm. You know, that's part of my creative process is one of discovery. And right. I don't remember writing this poem. I just remember after I wrote it having the idea, oh, I want to continue. I need to excavate my mother's memories. You know, I need to bring back that time period. But my creative process is really one of discovery. I never know what I'm going to write usually when I sit down.
It just comes. Do you, when you mentioned that this was pre-research, what you wrote this poem and then you wanted to continue on, what was the research like? Because your parents are obviously no longer here. How did you gather research? How does that work?
Yeah, you know, I ended up feeling a lot of regret that I didn't ask my mother for more stories, because then I had to create a lot of fictional characters, you know? So what I did is I read books. I read most of a book called After the Reich. It's this huge volume by McDonough, who, and he talks about the post-war experience of Germany and Austria. And he had a lot of details in there. So through researching, I could write about the bartering system. I knew how, you know, I could figure out how many bottles of schnapps were worth how many apricots and things like that. So I did that research. And he also has anecdotes in there that I used, some characters, like my character Hannah, for example, that's from that book. But then I also read a book in German called Besatzungskinder, which is occupation children. So these were children who were born of soldiers, Americans, British, Russian soldiers that were occupying these countries and then left and had children with some of the populace, you know, and they're called occupation children. So I read that and I wrote a couple poems based on characters from that book. Those were the main books that I ended up using.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because I'm actually working on a long essay about my grandmother, my grandmother. And because I'm realizing something you said made me think about it is all the questions I never asked. And so there's little tidbits of things here and there that I, you know, she's not here any longer. It's now developed into all the, you know, pretty much my female ancestry, all the things. It's more about the empty spaces, the things that I don't know. And I'm, you know, especially with your experience, even if you were in a place where you could have asked questions, your mother may not have been able to answer them, I'm assuming, when she was ill. So do you... I'm trying to wonder, as I'm working on my own writing, I'm realizing there's little memories that come to me that for some reason they're just popping up in my mind from when I was little, when I was a little girl. And I'm curious how much of this history of your parents may have influenced you as... not just as a writer, but as a human being, that how much of this maybe you perhaps absorbed without even probably reading some of those research books, some things that maybe, I don't know if I'm being as articulate as I would like, but from the perspective that I think sometimes there's these little nuggets of amazing knowledge we have as children that we don't really explore until we're adults, and some of us never explore them. So we have a little bit of an understanding, but not quite the whole picture. So maybe I think I'm understanding what my question to you is. It's twofold. One, I'd love to hear how, you know, your parents' history influenced you as the beautiful woman you are today. And I'm also wondering if maybe you didn't have the words to articulate all the questions you might have until you were an adult.
Yeah, I didn't. I think that's really common. I think children, they're not that interested in their parents' history. I mean, my kids don't know anything about my life, hardly. They're just not interested. They're interested in their own lives. I grew up, you know, caring about my friends and my social life. And what I really got from my mother through these stories and through my Austrian heritage was a real identification and sort of bicultural identification. So we used to go to Leoben a lot in the summers. And then later my parents moved to Vienna. And so I identified very strongly with my mother. I leaned on her so much, partly because my father was mentally ill and I didn't grow up feeling safe. And so, you know, I kind of needed her to protect me, and unfortunately, sometimes she didn't, but I always had that identification with her. And when I went to Austria, I always felt very at home. So my mother really influenced me as far as like her history, her Austrian heritage. Really, I embodied it. you know, it became part of who I am, to the point where I learned German. I lived in Germany. I you know, went to Austria all the time. They'd lived there for over 20 years when I got older. So I always had that identification. Another thing, and this is, I think I'm answering your question, but my mother had a lot of strength and resilience. She was a survivor. You know, this is this trait that people who go through hardships and trauma like that, they develop a resilience to move on, to the point where there was a certain amount of denial. Like she denied weakness often. And she always had to be strong and be the strong woman, take care of my, you know, mentally ill father, take care of her three children, pretend like everything's okay when it's not, you know, so there was a negative side to that too. But I carry a lot of who she is with me.
Mm-hmm. I think, you know, it is interesting. Maybe that's one of the characteristics of resilience, is how we are resilient is we put one foot in front of the other. And I don't even know how much of it we're pretending is normal. It's just that it has to be, you just can't think about it very, very much. I recently listened to a story on The Moth. I don't know if you ever listened to their, it's a podcast, it's a radio. And it was a woman who found out that her father was and had I'm trying to think, where were they, so that I could at least place it. But she found out after the war that her father had been an assassin. He assassinated people who were turning Jews into the Nazis. He was a kid. And how that affected him through life is, you know, you're talking about resilience, but how it affected her father was that he couldn't feel certain things, that part of him had to be turned off in order to have done what he did. So even though in some ways you could say he was a hero, you know, it's a very complicated way of looking at things. I mean, that time period, which you probably know more about than most of us in our generation, but how it also ultimately killed a part of him that wasn't able to acknowledge certain things. It's probably the way he survived. You know, we talk about survivor. We have to have these certain traits. How did I want to talk about the hunger part first, but how did that affect you growing up? The portion, you know, that your mom was often hungry, did that translate at all into your life and the life of your siblings in everyday life? Like, I know I have family that some of which, like when I was an adult entertaining, I had to have too much food, because I remember growing up, we always ran out of food. You know, we ran out of turkey, we ran out, you know, whatever it was. So when I would entertain, I had far too much, far, far too much. That's not about hunger per se, but it certainly is an influence from my childhood. How did that affect you even before you began to write the book, that whole feeling of a mom that was often hungry?
Wow. I hadn't really thought about this that much, except that, you know, my mother, one thing that I remember noticing, and I interpreted it at a young age, was my mother hoarded food a little bit. So we always had a cheese drawer that was so full of cheese. It was like ridiculous. Half of it was rotten. And I remember feeling like that was gross. We also, my mother loved to garden. She loved to cook. A lot of food was really, really important to her and feeding us well. She was an amazing cook. And then my relationship with food became complicated when I was a teenager. I was always dieting, because just about every teenager I knew was trying to be really skinny. This is in the '80s, right? So that happened to me. And later I actually developed food allergies. But that's gone now. That's not an issue. But that sort of hoarding quality that my mother had, that that preoccupation with making sure we always had enough, I think, came from a place of trauma and anxiety around food.
Oh, yeah. I would imagine this fear of it not being there someday. So I can't even imagine what that would be like. I just can't imagine what it's like to be hungry all the time. I've been very blessed. I've never had to worry about that. It's heartbreaking. It's kind of, you and I were talking a little bit about this. There's the research, they're doing research now, and I should have it right in front of me, and I don't, but the children in many of these war-torn areas, no one's paying attention really to the children, and the children end up with long-lasting trauma, PTSD, but how does it influence their development and what happens, 10 years from now to these children? And I don't know. I'm just throwing this. I don't even know if you know the answer to this question. But has there ever been, to your knowledge, studies of the effects of the emotional trauma for the children left after the Holocaust?
I did not do that research, but I just can't imagine that it hasn't. I mean, what is that called? Adverse childhood experiences, right? The ACE.
Yeah.
So that really, I mean, that literally affects people's physical health if they get older. Mm-hmm. If as children they grow up with a lot of trauma, they're more likely to get cancer and high blood pressure and all these diseases, right? Because ultimately, you start to realize, especially as you get older, that there's really truly no separation between the body and the spirit and the emotional self, mm-hmm. and they're so integrated. And if you do have trauma or adverse childhood experiences, it's going to affect your health. So there's no doubt in my mind that there are those repercussions. I haven't done that research though.
Yeah. And I'd like to look into it more just from personal, because I can't, children are incredibly resilient for sure, but we carry that trauma in our bodies. And, I think it's just something as a culture we could do a better job.
And I wonder about my mother sometimes, mm-hmm. what made her get Alzheimer's, to grow up malnourished for years, to experience the amount of stress she had. It's interesting. She ended up with a disease that was all about forgetting,
Was she, so she was very young. Did her parents survive the war? So your grandparents?
Her mother didn't. Well, her mother died when my mom was about 9, so post-war. Mm-hmm. She died of lupus at the age of 35.
Okay.
And then her father died in his early 50s. He was a chain smoker. He died of lung cancer, I think, in the 50s. Mm-hmm. So she lost both parents relatively early. We don't have a lot of longevity in our family. I worry about that. But and then she got early onset Alzheimer's at the age of 60. She was already showing symptoms. Yeah.
Yeah, that must have been very, very challenging for you. I think, I wonder, is some part of writing occupied? Do you feel that it's important to tell your mother's stories? Is it a way of you trying to understand your parents better? Is it none of these things? Is it, I think sometimes I'm just as curious about why we feel driven to do the creative work we are driven to do. And is it, do you think, a way? I mean, you use the term foraging your, memories. And is it a way of trying to remain connected to your mother, trying to honor her memory? Or do you have any thoughts about those types of things?
Yeah, honoring her memory. I think that speaks to me the most. I think I, the, you know, I've, feel that I have been haunted by my parents my whole life. And I've done tons of therapy around it, and I had a challenging childhood. My father was severely mentally ill. And so that's why in this book, the first part, I just decided, okay, I'm going to honor Austria and Germany after the war, which is when my mother was a child. I'm going to honor her history. And then the second half of the book, I kind of look, which gives that double entendre of occupied, me being occupied with my parents and my history, with my father and my mother. And so, I wrote those stories. And quite frankly, I feel like I'm done. I'm like, done. I did it. I did the whole book about my parents. I think I'm going to stop writing about them. I mean, I wrote about my mother obsessively. Even my first book, Rust, I have my mother in it because I wrote that book when I was managing her care. And it totally preoccupied me. It was a lot of work. I had to visit her in the nursing home and manage all her care and, the paperwork, everything, trying to make her life, trying to help her have some dignity as she lost it in this disease. I've spent so much time looking back in that way, and I'm hoping that my future work will look forward a little more.
Well, were you writing this when I met you? Because I remember when we, correct me if I'm wrong in my memory, but I remember, the process listeners, for those of you who have not written for the conversation part on our stories today, is I send my participants a series of questions and they get to choose 5 or 6 and then they answer them. And Kika had sent me her answers and then we met for our photo shoot. And it was while we were talking that you shared with me a little bit of this history. But you didn't touch upon it in your original answers. And I can remember, I think you were standing in front of one of the shots where I was doing in front of the tree. And I just was you just let some information drop. And I was like, Kika, this should be in there. If you're comfortable, this should be in there. And suddenly, and that's part of the thing I love about photo shoots is when things are, it's the conversation. Suddenly have an insight into a human being that you didn't have before, and everything is three-dimensional. So that would have been, is it a year and a half? So you must have been working on this at that time. Yeah.
Yeah. At the time when I met with you, I had two projects going on at once. So I was writing this book and then, I was working on a lot of short stories based on a character named Joan and their dark humor, completely different than my poetry, which I've pretty much abandoned at that project at this point. But yeah, and so I would go back and forth writing these vastly different things, this sort of dark poetry about post-war Austria, and then these absurd stories about disastrous character named Joan.
It's, it's interesting how you describe your poetry as dark, because it's definitely, if I were to visualize it, I'm always visualizing a forest and it's not sunny and it's damp. And, this is just what gets conjured up in my mind. But at the same time, there's some, as I'm talking to you, I'm starting to realize it, because it's all, to me, almost about a story of survival, and holding on. And part of it too, this is coming to me just as I'm talking to you, but part of it is also how you can be very young and be in a situation that seems like today, in our world today, which is pretty freaking miserable, let's face it. Never mind, but I don't want to get into that right now. But we don't even have an ounce of experience that's very similar to this. And I don't have this experience. There are people, there's one of the, I want to read something that you wrote shortly that kind of linking the past with today. But I look, as I read through this, I also see that the amazing survival sensation that we have as human beings, that we don't tend to just lay down and let things run over us. I mean, your characters go through hell, but there's something in there that is very, part of it is your language. Your use of language is just extraordinary. The metaphors that I could never, and they're so accurate, and you have such a visual experience as you're reading your poetry. So even though you're saying they're dark, there's something in them that is uplifting. And I'm having a hard time articulating it, but it perhaps does come back to the resilience that we started talking about at the very beginning, how we can go through so, so much, and still the human spirit desires to survive.
Yeah, and I think in my writing, you know, I always tell my students, be vulnerable on the page. Mm-hmm. So that's because that's what I do. And so, and I do find that that's where some of the more authentic and emotional poetry comes from, when you can really be vulnerable on the page. And so, yeah, I mean, I think that my poetry, I would hope that there is sort of a light to it too. It's not totally dark, because these characters, they love each other. They're mm-hmm. family. They're trying to take care of each other. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a tenderness there. There's, you know, I have children. There are children who had to, at a very young age, like my aunt, for example, you know, they have to suddenly take care of their siblings. They have mm-hmm. to play a mother role. They have to work towards survival, you know, and all of that is really beautiful. Mm-hmm. You know, I think
it is. I think we're, you know, in some ways our society, we like to look at the pretty things, you know, the pretty things and the big smile, you know, the big smiles. And I like to joke that, you know, it's this idea that we manifest whatever we want, when we forget that the things that seem dark or hard or uncomfortable are quite beautiful, because that's the essence of the human spirit. That's what I think you get in this book. You know, granted, I don't write poetry, but I love to read poetry. And that's that essence of being a human being and the good things in the bad times. I'm curious too, because we haven't really talked about your dad. How did your parents meet? Maybe that's a good, do you know how they met, or was it, you know, what were the circumstances?
They were both going to the Sorbonne in Paris in the 1960s. And they met in a music appreciation class. So my father composed music and played piano. That was his obsession. That's how he spent his time. And they did not know each other very well. They were only together about 3 months, and then pretty much had a shotgun wedding, because my mother was pregnant with me. Mm-hmm. And he flew her, she didn't even know English very well. So he flew her back to the United States, to the University of Wisconsin, to Madison, where he was at the university working on his PhD. And he, you know, my mother had me, and my first language was actually German. She didn't speak English to me the first 4 years of my life, because she was still learning English. And, you know, unfortunately, my mother did not know his history, and she mm-hmm. did not know he was mentally ill until he became extremely paranoid and ended up with a nervous breakdown when I was quite young. So I was afraid of him. She said I used to hide behind her whenever he came home. I was terrified of him. And he had, growing up, you know, he had multiple nervous breakdowns. We used to be told that he was a paranoid schizophrenic, but now what they used to call that is that he was bipolar, but he had psychotic episodes and delusions. Mm-hmm. And he always had this idea of conspiracies. And sometimes we would be part of those conspiracies, and that's when he became pretty scary. He ended up in a mental hospital at one point. He tried to commit suicide when I was 11. You know, it was hard. And my mother stayed with him, and their relationship, I mean, I don't understand why she kept having children with him, quite frankly. And I don't understand why she stayed with him. She basically took care of him. Mm-hmm. He became the biggest child in the house. She made sure he took his meds. She tried to keep him in control. And, you know, it was not a healthy environment for sure. And when I left at 18 to go to college, I was so happy to get away. I mean, I just needed to get away.
And then he, I mean, you say in your book that he ultimately did commit suicide.
He did, yeah. So what happened is my mother, they were living in Vienna. So they moved back to Vienna when we left the house, when their children were gone. And my mother, you know, was developing Alzheimer's and losing her memory, and it was just getting worse and worse. So my father was in a situation where he had to take care of her, whereas she had always taken care of him. Mm-hmm. And I suspect he stopped taking his meds. And I visited them there, and I knew he was in bad shape. You know, he was really skinny. He was not doing well. And, you know, I said, "Dad, I think you're depressed. I think you need to hire someone to help you with Mom. You know, I think it's not working out." He said, "No, no, I'm fine." We were, at this point, we were on the Danube, you know, standing next to the Danube. And he said, "Oh, no, no, we're not there yet. I'm fine." And this was August. Mm-hmm. And then by October, he had committed suicide.
I can't even imagine what you had to deal with. I mean, I think from the, you know, what you told me and what you wrote in the Our Stories today, that's, you had children of your own. Your parents were essentially children. I mean, at that point, really desperately needing you. Everybody needed Kika.
Yeah.
That's a hard place. I mean, many women to certain variations experience that, but we always seem to do it at the detriment of ourselves, ultimately, you know. And to see you, you know, I hear you when you say you think you're done. I'm wondering, I'm not your therapist, obviously, but I'm wondering if this work has finally, or has somehow created for you whatever it was you needed to create to, and I hate saying the words like make peace or come full circle, but some kind of inner reckoning that you needed to tell the stories of your parents with, like you said, dignity and to honor their memories the best you could. Because it's very clear that there, you know, we're victims of obviously our past, and that comes through in this quite deeply. Before I ask you some other questions, I'm curious if would you like to read another? I know you chose another poem, and tell us a little bit about it before you read.
Well, this, I was going to read Krieglergasse, which is the street where my parents lived in Vienna. And I actually have given you most of the background information. This is when I visited them. It's about sort of realizing what was happening. And mm-hmm. I guess what, by reading it, you'll get more images of Vienna and their life there and what it was like to visit them. So it's called Krieglergasse. It's the cobblestone street of the warrior where my parents lived on the third floor of an apartment building with stone steps worn and dark from centuries of feet climbing. My father drank wine and Vienna's music in rooms with chandeliers and velvet. My mother taught Mormons German and fed the wood ducks on the Danube Canal. She slept through May's hail, a sky exhaling ice falling on me as I rode my bike. She woke to find parts of her missing, buttons lost that had closed a memory into a body, thread coming undone from the spool tangled on their floors. Father was visiting the preacher, ladling out Jesus. He was starving himself. I watched them, how their train slipped off the tracks, derailed, tilted, jolting to a stop, how my father's Jesus gave him a handful of nails, the city cleaned the black soot off Stephanskirche, and the tourists ambled into Schönbrunn to learn about Queen Elizabeth, her hair long, thick, and pendulous, so dark like Vienna's woods. Once I visited them and my mother couldn't play backgammon anymore, the black chips confounding, the stripes too parallel for her jagged mind. My children were young. My husband called me and told me the dog had killed our blue parakeet, Indigo. The children cried. I bought them baklava from the Turks. I spun that evening, waltzing at a ball, wearing a green velvet dress in a city where warriors laid down weapons and sang. I ran along the canal where men trained shepherds to attack, their bodies crashing into the padded pillows dangling from a chestnut tree, vicious warriors of a Vienna that broke for me, shattered into splinters made of my mother's gold crown and my father's dissonant black key from a piano he stopped playing. The chestnut bloom survived May's hail. I returned to Colorado. I bought a new bird. She was tiny and white. She sat on my shoulder when I mopped my floors in a house in my country that nested half of me. The other half was in Vienna. It was made of shade, green threads in the Vienna woods where I gathered nettles and chanterelles. I left the poisonous mushrooms to the earthen floor. Others hunted the wild boar. We ate them as medallions, round and peppered with the mushrooms sautéed in butter, pillows from the rich soil of the forest that only grow in the shadows.
Wow. How long does it take you to write something like that?
You know, that poem came out of me so fast, and I wrote it after I had conceived the book. Like, I thought, I need to have one poem in here that really describes their life in Vienna, because it wasn't there before. So that poem came really fast. I mean, that poem I wrote probably in like a half hour. I mean, obviously it went through revision, but then some poems that I write, you know, they'll take a couple hours because I keep revising and editing and looking back. And
that, it's funny too, because I know I've told this story so many times, but I don't think on the podcast. I went to a writer's workshop once and Donald Hall was reading his poetry, and you know, he suddenly stopped. He said, "Whoever has my book," he said, "cross this out. I like this word better." And all of us sat there a little bit like, "What?" He said, "I'm the author. I can change it whenever I want."
That's great.
It's just, yeah. I mean, some of the things that you know, the language that you use, I mean, especially where I don't know why, but that one sentence that she woke to find parts of her missing. It's a very simple, quiet sentence in some ways, but it is so supremely powerful. And how I can't, you know, when you think of someone with any type of dementia, how there's suddenly parts that are just missing. I don't know that for me personally, that really hit me, as well as some of your other language. So the way your book is described, is organized, obviously starts at a very, the chapter mostly on hunger has mostly to do when they're children. And then we get into the later part of the book is a later part of life.
Yeah.
There's something that I want to read to you and chat a little bit about. It was on my list in the foreword, which I think is such a beautiful foreword too. Just, you know, I really appreciate that it gave some kind of framing to what I was about to read. And for someone who has not read and does not know your history, it just really frames things quite nicely. But one of the paragraphs you write is, "This book was written as a warning, as much as a way to find closure and create words out of my mother's ashes. It brings to life a past that is all too present for many people on our planet, and it embraces the children and mothers who are just trying to take care of a delicate and fragile future to watch their children grow." Can we talk a little bit about that? How, because that was something else I had said to you in our earlier conversation, that reading this, it's about the past, but there's something very timely in it as well. And I think, you know, there's hunger. There's many different types of hunger, obviously, too. What did you mean when you said that?
Well, what I meant actually is that, and I think this is very appropriate for this time period, we live in a country with systemic racism, you know, Germany, for example, the Weimar Republic was pretty liberal before Hitler came into power, but the systemic racism was still there, as it is in our country, which we see in our Justice Department, we see we see in all our institutions and the economic reality where, the disparity, there are in our country who are hungry.
No, go ahead.
So there's that. And, I think that, we also need to really pay attention to who ends up in power. We do not want to be in a situation where we are in war, because the people who pay the price of war are, as I say, the children.
Yes, that I heard. I mean, that you really get a strong sense of there. And I think your word of warning is true. I think that one of the beautiful things about reading poetry is you can visit history without the type of investment that requires you to read one of the research books you were talking about. So that for people who want a feeling to feel what it might have been like for these children, this is a perfect opportunity for them. And it's so true. And I think it's, I was watching we're not going to talk about this per se, but I want to, it's a way to frame my story, when watching the debate last night, which was horrifying. And a number of the newscasters were talking about friends of theirs that were texting them about what happened with their children. And that one person got a message saying their children had to run into another room, was terrified by what was going on. Another child did something similar, but the point is that our children are not just the ones who, will end up, whatever seeds we're sowing today, that's what our children will be left with for many years. So there's the issue of the trauma, then there's the issue of resolving so many of these inequities that will ultimately pave the way for how our children move forward in the future, through whether it's through a system that agrees to systemic racism, or a system that feels that we are here to all take care of each other and make sure that whoever is in power, that we are trying to defeat these different types of hunger, actually, is the word I'm going to use. To borrow from you. So I think that you make that case quite powerfully in your book. And I think the ability to, I would like you to read your poems everywhere, have people hear them. And I think the big part of that is that the best way for us to avoid that exact example that you gave is to understand what has come before us. I think there's a part of us in our culture that says, no, that can't possibly happen. No, that these things can't possibly happen again. That was then, this is now. And what they don't understand is what happened during that time period. It wasn't like overnight all these countries were occupied. There's a very, like exactly what you said, the racism was there. It just took a man like Hitler to really flame that fire.
I think there's a real danger. I do think it could happen here, quite frankly. And I'm really worried. I also My role, really, my most important role is that of a mother. Mm-hmm. I mean, this was a mistake my mother made, because her most important role really was a wife, to the point where she made some mistakes as a mother, I believe, in protecting us. But my most important role is really as a mother. Mm-hmm. And I am more invested in the future than I've ever been in my life, mm-hmm. because of that, because this is the world that I have brought them into. Right. So mm-hmm. I feel very responsible for it. And I worry about my children. I worry about the future. I worry about global warming, racism, this country. I'm very worried about mm-hmm. this country. And then now we're going through the pandemic, you know. There are a lot of things to worry about.
There are so many things to worry about. And like you, it's exactly, I think that's one of the reasons I feel connected to you, is that's my view, is the long range for as a mother as well, and a grandmother. I think when my granddaughter was born, it became even more powerful, if that was possible, because the understanding of, I'm with you in believe you as well, that I'm very frightened for our nation and for our direction. And I do think it could happen here too. And when I say that, often people are like, oh, no. But I think that's how we are culturally. It's like what we were talking about before, where we want to look at the pretty things. And we can still do that, but we need to understand that there is something very, very powerful that we need to be warned about. I have loved speaking with you, and I would love to, I wish we could sit here and just have you read every single one of these poems. I have as we conclude, would like to give you an opportunity to, if there's something else you would like to say, or if you feel you would like to read another poem, we have about maybe 5 more minutes that we can. I want to make sure that I've given your voice the power that it deserves. So this is an opportunity for you to let us know either what you most want us to take away from this, or perhaps read something else. I will leave that to you.
I think I'll just say a little bit about how you can find me and how you can find my book. So Occupied, you can find it on Amazon. I also have my website, KikaDorsey.com. And you can also get it at Pinion Publishing. If you'd like to support a small press, that's the way to go. They're the ones that published it. I just want people to come away from this book ultimately with a sense, once again, that this is a little bit of a warning, with a sense maybe of curiosity of their own heritage and history. You know, what are the stories? If I did read a poem, which I won't because it's too long, but my poem Hannah, which is the last poem of the first section, ends where she said she has her ear to the earth and she says, "I'm listening." And I think ultimately that is the wisdom we need to take from our experiences, is being able to really listen to history, listen to our children, listen to people before we project who we think they are, or we project otherness onto them because they are a different race or culture, right? Find those ties of humanity by being a good listener. And I think, what we all really long for is inner peace. Certainly, after the war, there was peace, but there was hunger, right? So we want inner peace. And in order to create inner peace, we have to create outer peace. And we have to create a social net where we are taking care of each other. You know, a lot of my book is about caretaking. We need to take care of each other instead of fight each other, instead of project onto each other an enemy that is really just the shadow sides of ourselves.
Yeah. And I have to tell you, your voice is powerful. And I think with everything that you just said, all of those messages come through in here. We can't find any inner peace without all of us working together and taking care of each other. And it's partly, I mean, you get some of these messages in here too, even though some of them are a little bit dark, but your characters couldn't move forward all by themselves. They had to be able to get, you know, some type of bartering, some type of, I have what you need, you have what I need. Some type of shared desire to be in a place that was peaceful as well. And all I can say is I would like to implore everybody to check out Occupied, Vienna is a Broken Man and Daughter of Hunger, and definitely follow Kika. I'm going to have in the show notes how you can reach out to Kika. And I'm actually going to go buy your other two books because I have not read those. And this one was just, you've given us all a tremendous gift. And I'd like to thank you. Thank you. Thank you for being
thank
a part.
Thank you so much. It was such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Thank you for listening to today's conversation. I'm always on the lookout for inspiring and fascinating women over 50 to spotlight on the Women Words Wisdom podcast. If you believe you or someone you know would be a great candidate, please visit the podcast page of ourstoriestoday.com to learn more. You can find the link in the show notes.